here's a story from The World.
The China Dream is a political slogan you might have heard before. It's been associated with Xi Jinping since he became China's president in 2013.
Long live the Great People's Republic of China.
But Xi's ambition is much bigger than just the People's Republic. It's really a global vision. The signature policy for implementing it is called the New Silk Road, or the Belt and Road. The vision? A belt of land routes and a maritime silk road of sea routes, connecting China with Europe and beyond. Most countries around the world have already signed up to the project in one way or another. It'll have profound implications on the global climate, trade, politics, infrastructure, you name it. We're kicking off a weekly series today about how China's dream is playing out across the globe. It's a partnership with the Global Reporting Center and Mary Kay Magstad, creators of a new podcast called On China's New Silk Road. Mary Kay is also a former China correspondent for The World. She's in San Francisco now. Hey, Mary Kay.
Hi, Marco.
We're also joined by journalist Shuang Li, who's from the city of Chengdu in southwestern China. Shuang Li co-reported the first episode of the podcast and is also speaking to us from her home in Oakland, California. Hi, Shuang.
Hi, good morning.
Good day to you. So the Chinese government's pitching its Belt and Road vision as a win-win for China and for the rest of the world. What does that mean, win-win, from Beijing's perspective?
Well, from Beijing's perspective, in terms of how it pitches it to countries around the world, it means China's going to take the expertise that it built up over decades of building infrastructure at home and getting increasingly good at it, and it's going to do the same thing in other countries to help boost their economies, the same way that it boosted China's economy at home. Recipient countries have different opinions about the extent to which this is a win-win. In some cases, it really has helped local economies. In other cases, some people joke, it seems like it's a double win for China because it's Chinese loans, often at rates that are above what the World Bank would charge and with shorter payback periods. And it's usually Chinese construction teams that come in, so it doesn't necessarily create a lot of jobs for local people. The hope is for local governments that accept these projects that this will help allow more, you know, particularly when China's building roads, railways, ports, pipelines, 5G telecommunications, that it will just provide more capacity in the recipient country that will help it become a stronger economy.
Right. And who's winning and who's not is something you get into in the series. The Belt and Road Project, I mean, it's about trade and transportation, infrastructure and finance, but you also get into this. It's also about what we call soft power and China's influence as a global power. How's that all working?
No, absolutely. It's about soft power and hard power. And this is the thing. When you talk about it possibly being a double win for China and you look at where China's building out infrastructure, it's in places where it matters to China, that it has access to resources or it has access to ports. In terms of the soft power aspect, which is, you know, the power to attract, to make people like you, to make perhaps countries want to emulate you, the Chinese government certainly would love for other countries to say, hey, you've done such a great job building up your economy. You are a success. You've done this through having a strong centralized government, not so much democracy. And we think that's a great way to go. The problem is that other authoritarian countries around the world don't have the technocratic chops that China does, by and large. And a lot of democratic countries don't necessarily find China's approach attractive. So that aspect of soft power isn't working so well. Also, at the moment, we have something called wolf warrior diplomacy coming out of China, a much harder edged, more aggressive approach to diplomacy and to basically pushing back against criticisms of China. And that's not playing well either.
It's the city of Chengdu that's the starting point for the series. Shuang, you grew up in Chengdu. It was a period when economic transformation was at liftoff. What did that feel like in Chengdu?
I left Chengdu in 2002 and come back once or twice a year to visit. And the city just keeps on growing and changing. Now we have 6 million more people than when I left. And then most of the places I knew were gone. My old schools, my grandparents' homes, my friends have moved several homes across town. And where used to be farmland now is considered inner city. Where there was a road got turned into a bridge in a couple of years. So everything is just changing so fast. I see that that's happening all over China, but I understand this is my way of looking at things. I wonder how people think in other places when it comes to places being changed.
So now China is taking that considerable experience building infrastructure in China and doing the same around the globe. How do you think that's going? I mean, did China think it would be easier than it is?
I feel it's simple if we just look at the building itself, because China is capable of building things very fast. But I worry and I look at things when China goes out to build in other countries, problems like, does the people there actually need that infrastructure? Not just the government needs it, but the people there actually need it. And will they be able to pay back the loan? Will the infrastructure impact the environment? Will the construction impact local communities? Those questions, I don't know how well it's being answered before the deals.
Shuang Li, you're also in the Bay Area. How does it feel to be living in California right now when the tensions between the U.S. and China are so high?
I actually feel the interest towards China from people here in the U.S. cannot compare with the interest from people in China towards the U.S. Here, people, if your job is not related to China, I hardly hear people talk about China. I don't feel there's that much interest. The differences, there's so much interest from China towards the U.S., and then there are a lot more Chinese who are concerned about the tensions between the two countries.
So we're going to hear an excerpt now from the first episode of On China's New Silk Road. Mary Kay Magstad and Shuang Li, thank you very much for the setup to episode one.
Thank you, Marco.
Thank you.
And where we pick up this excerpt is in Hong Kong at a ceremony celebrating, with gold confetti, the Belt and Road Project.
A very warm welcome to the second edition of the Belt and Road International Food Expo 2019 Hong Kong.
Diplomats lined up on stage to clink champagne glasses with Chinese officials.
Let's say cheers together. Ready? 3, 2, 1, cheers! Congratulations and a great success to Belt and Road International Food Expo Hong Kong 2019.
The Europeans on stage looked a bit bemused as gold confetti rained down.
After the toasting ceremony, we'll be now proceeding to the signing of several memorandums of understanding by the representatives of our country pavilions and witnessed by their government trade departments.
Once all that wrapped up, everyone spilled into the exhibition hall, where hundreds of vendors from dozens of Belt and Road countries were promoting goods like rice from Vietnam, chocolate spread from Indonesia, wine from Slovenia, frozen food from Pakistan, and produce from Peru. Peru's consul general to Hong Kong, Sergio Avila Traverso, was measured in his thoughts about the Belt and Road.
One Belt, One Road, let's say in the future, could be a good system. Now I think it's a very young, organization, schema.
In the United States, and certainly in the current administration, there's some anxiety, I think, about the Belt and Road and, you know, the political aspirations perhaps behind the economic build-out. What do you think Americans need to understand about the Belt and Road from your perspective?
I think also the United States was one of the open market leader historically, no? And I think the world is changing. It's a globalization. And I think the world is for all. And yes, the market is big, and I think we all can survive and we can all have good advantages.
Over at the Philippines booth, the Philippines Consul General to Hong Kong, Antonio Morales, said much the same. That's interesting, given how friendly Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte has been to China, despite the two countries' conflicting claims in the South China Sea.
Well, as they say, in the past, all roads led to Rome. We don't think that now it will be all roads leading to Beijing, but that there will be complementarities among the players in the region. It will be a more complicated, complex world with many centers of economic, political, military powers, and sometimes one is preeminent over the others in certain areas and at certain points. But it's not as simple as seeing as one dominating the others.
Which might just be a blind spot for China's leaders. President Xi Jinping has worked hard to strengthen his own power within China and China's power in the world, including here in Hong Kong, where a new national security law has led to a clampdown on criticism of the Chinese government, with arrests ranging from teenage pro-democracy protesters to the head of one of Hong Kong's biggest media companies, Jimmy Lai. A year before that law was passed, I talked with pro-democracy protesters who were then out in the streets. A pastor in his 60s, who asked that his name not be used, predicted what would happen if a national security law came into force.
So people would be living in fear. They would probably begin to have self-censorship on their freedom, on their speech and everything. Probably the freedom of press would be gone too.
As we talked, the crowd of protesters swelled, with some protesters helping others over concrete barriers and handing out masks, so surveillance cameras wouldn't as easily be able to identify who was protesting. About an hour after our conversation, Hong Kong police used tear gas and rubber bullets on this crowd. It was the first time they'd used rubber bullets. But here, in this moment, in June 2019, the pastor tells me he's surprised the Chinese government is doing all this now, since it had promised that from the 1997 handover from British to Chinese rule, Hong Kong would be able to keep its own system of governance, its own way of life, for 50 years.
But it seems like the Chinese government can't wait already.
And when it all started, a lot of people thought I was here for the handover, covering it. A lot of people were saying, you know, maybe Hong Kong will help change China.
Yeah, I had the same dream too. I was a little bit younger then, but...
Aren't we all?
Yeah. But 22 years later, I don't think that's the case. It's getting worse.
So it's a little ironic that this is happening at a moment when China's really trying to make a case to the world that, you know, China should build out the Belt and Road, that, you know, the center of global trade should be China, that, you know, it'll build infrastructure in all these different countries and everyone should trust China and believe that it's going to be a win-win. What, if anything, do you think Hong Kong's experience should tell people who are considering getting into that kind of a relationship with China?
This would be sensitive. Well, I think you need to realize that they can say one thing and do another. So you better watch out.
Around the world, people are weighing the costs and benefits of partnering with China on the new Silk Road. In some cases, it's going well. In other cases, initial enthusiasm has been tempered by doubts born of experience dealing with China. There are also concerns about recent Chinese aggression in the South China Sea, on China's border with India, in making new territorial claims in Bhutan, and even in rhetoric called wolf warrior diplomacy. This was named after Chinese action films in which those who criticize China pay. And China's foreign minister, Wang Yi, has defended this approach.
We never pick a fight or bully others, but we have principles and guts. We will push back against any deliberate insult to resolutely defend our national honor and dignity.
So Chinese diplomats have taken to Twitter, slamming those who suggest that China didn't do enough to stop COVID-19 from becoming a pandemic. Nonsense, some have said. Maybe the U.S. military brought the virus here, or maybe it came from Italy. Maybe we'll boycott your products until you stop saying that. Shuang's not a fan of the wolf warrior approach.
Yeah, very aggressive, pointing fingers at everybody and targeting the U.S., targeting Australia. It makes me feel like after this, we really don't have friends left. Like, what are we showing the world who we are?
Big powers bullying others rarely plays well. Americans have learned that over time. They've also learned that once you're a big enough power to affect the lives of people beyond your borders, those people are going to have opinions about you, and not always positive ones. Chinese are still learning how to take criticism about their country's actions in the world.
This thin skin thing, they're going to have to come to terms with this. This is a major problem.
This is Larry Greenwood again, the former U.S. diplomat and former Asian Development Bank vice president.
I have so many friends in China that even privately, they just explode with rage, you know, at some of the things that are said about them. Many of them are not true. But, you know, if you want to be world leader, live with it, because that's what world leadership is all about. People are going to hate your guts. world leaders are not popular.
Within China, it's taken as a given that China has earned the right to lead through its long history and old Silk Road days as a powerful economy and innovator, through enduring what Chinese schoolchildren learn was humiliation at the hands of foreign powers, from Britain's opium wars to Japanese occupation, and through China's own extraordinary economic transformation over the past four decades, which many Chinese genuinely celebrate. At the military parade celebrating 70 years of Communist Party rule, crowds cheered, tanks rolled, and Xi Jinping smiled. It's taken effort to consolidate his power and silence his rivals and critics, and it's not over. A new political purge is underway.
We must continue to consolidate and develop this People's Republic and continue our struggle to achieve the two centenary goals and to realize the Chinese dream of national rejuvenation.
To achieve those goals, President Xi has called for military-civilian fusion, merging China's military and civilian efforts and technologies, and having state enterprises and private companies work more closely together to help China rise in the world and to achieve President Xi's version of the China dream. But individual Chinese have long had their own dreams, some not so different from the American dream. As the saying goes in China, people can sleep in the same bed, but they'll have different dreams. And outside of China, on the New Silk Road, China's leaders are discovering what a challenge it is to make people dream your dream, much less accept it as their reality.
More from the podcast on China's New Silk Road every Monday in the weeks to come. Mary Kay Magsa, before I let you go, that does sound a lot like the old Coca-Cola jingle or the New Seekers song, I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing. What is the deal with that? And what did China pay for the rights to that kind of soft power?
So no idea what China paid, but when the fifth anniversary of Xi Jinping announcing the Belt and Road came up in 2018, they launched this take, shall we say, or this riff on the Coca-Cola jingle.
Well, at least they have a song to go along with the new Silk Road project. Mary Kay, talk to you next Monday.
Sounds great. Thanks, Marco.